And you are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. 1890 453 106 is our number. Our text number is 53106. It will cost you 30 cents. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter or send us an email to afternoon@newstalk.com. As you'll know, this time on a Wednesday is usually our parenting slot. And today we're not going to do the parenting slot because, as you probably also know, our David Carey passed away last Thursday afternoon around 3 o'clock. We heard... I think we'd just come off air when we heard. The last time I saw him was, I think, maybe a week or a little bit more than a week before that in St. James's Hospital, which happened to be his 70th birthday. And we had a glass of bubbly and a bit of cake then. And since we announced that, and since we announced it on Friday at the end of the show, and it is absolutely overwhelming, the amount of texts and tweets and emails that have come in from people. And I could be here for the next 3 days reading them all out. And people express now they've felt, so many people texting to say, I am sitting in my car crying now about a man I never met. So many people mentioned his voice, particularly how much they loved his voice and the timbre of that voice and how it made them feel warm and calm. And I do want to try and just read a couple of emails very quickly before we play the piece we're going to play. This one person says, before I ever realistically contemplated children, I religiously listened to David, mentally taking notes from my future family. I always thought David's advice was so real and loved how we always, always saw things from the child's perspective and advocated for children first and foremost. But life doesn't always go as planned. And for years, I battled infertility. It was the most horrendous, painful journey. There were times I gave up and I never thought I'd become a parent. I distanced myself from everything to do with parenthood, as it was too painful. But for some reason, even when I was at my lowest, I still found myself tuning in every Wednesday. I always found David's voice so soothing, calming and reassuring. After 5 years, 12 various fertility treatments and 8 IVFs, I gave birth to a beautiful baby. Believe me when I say that listening to the parenting slot afterwards felt like such a magical milestone moment. I cried listening to David's beautiful voice, holding my baby and realising I was finally a parent, listening to the parenting slot. It's a moment I will never forget. Thank you, David. Another person says, I was 2 years ago, my husband and I were in dire straits, not knowing where to turn to help for our son. My husband listens to your show religiously and had mentioned the segment that featured David, so we decided to contact him directly. And after much waiting, we got to meet him at his practice. He immediately made us feel at ease, who reassured us as parents that we were doing everything we could and he was there to support us. When we explained our son's difficulty, his response was, I can't wait to meet this little guy, he sounds like a great character. Over the course of the 2 years that followed, we met and corresponded with him via email, and he set us on the right path. His humour, wit and passion for helping young children will be a great loss. We are eternally grateful to David for all the help he gave us. May he rest in peace. And I suppose that's something that we shouldn't overlook, in that while he gave a lot of people assistance and reassurance on this show by day during his practice, he was a psychologist, and every now and again, I mean, he'd come in every Wednesday and we'd start yakking, then we'd go in there and do the questions, then there'd be an ad break and we'd keep yakking. Every now and again, he'd tell me stories of some of the cases he had to deal with. And my God, some of the poor kids out there were so horrendously stressed, had such appalling experiences. And he literally saved people's lives. He literally saved people's lives. Which is nothing to be sniffed at, that's for sure. Though Geraldine also emailed in today, just after we mentioned David's death. She says, she's a friend, she says, I've known him for over 25 years and I could hear him laughing at you, but at the same time ticking you off. And she's so accurate in that as well. So accurate in that. Now, what we're going to play for you is an interview we recorded with David many years ago. It was played out on Christmas Day in 2013. And it was about his life and times, because he's a very interesting life story and his general attitudes. So the first question I asked him was, what's the first thing you remember? What's the first thing you remember in your life?
Oh, gosh. The very first thing I remember is a rather distressing thing, actually. I lived in a flat with my mother, my father, my grandfather, and my grandmother, my mother's parents. Mm. I was a young boy. This was probably around the age of 3. I remember very vividly eating whilst sitting on my grandfather's lap. That was a good memory. And that's a very strong memory. The second, even more powerful memory, however, is my father taking me in a big black car in the middle of the afternoon, driving away from the apartment. And I was very confused. I had absolutely no idea what was going on. And I remember being frightened and distressed by this. And it transpired that my grandmother had died in the family home, and the undertakers were coming to remove her body. And no one had told me, and they didn't want to cause me upset. Inevitably, they did, of course, by having me there in the home and all this went on. So my father took me for a drive around town in this big black car. So those are my two early memories. One, a very happy memory of eating my dinner off my grandfather's lap. And the other, this rather distressing and disconcerting memory of being driven away from the family home. I don't even know how long we were driving, actually. And I don't have clear memories of my grandmother, because she was so ill at the time that she was confined to bed for months and months and months.
What town was it?
This was in Waterbury, Connecticut, which is a once famous industrial town. It was, during the heyday of its life, the brass manufacturing center of the world. Now, if you think of World War I and the post-war period, World War II and the Korean conflict, you'll think of things that brass was used for, shell casings, the buttons on military uniforms. So we had in Waterbury, Connecticut, three gigantic brass mills. And these are where my father, grandfather, and uncles were employed. They're all gone now. There is no brass industry. The mills have all been torn down and demolished. There's nothing left but flat land. As a result, over the years following, let's say, the early 70s, the town fell into great decline. It's now a rather sad and unfortunate city, about 120,000 population, very mixed population. It's on a river. In my day as a child, the river ran orange, chartreuse, and blue from the pollution of the brass manufacturing plants, and occasionally it would set itself on fire.
That must have been kind of dramatic and pretty, but horrible at the same time.
It was quite horrible and very powerful in terms of odor. Mm. But it was cleaned up tremendously over the years, and now it's actually a river you can fish in. Believe it or not.
Did you have many siblings?
I had no siblings. Mm. I am an adopted only child. And I was adopted in my family. My birth mother was actually the first cousin to the woman, my mother, who raised me. So I came from the hospital to my mother and father's home. They could not have children. So no sibs. Well, the answer to that actually is yes or no.
Yes and no, actually. Maybe we'll get to that later.
Okay.
Being the only child, were you spoiled a bit? Were you the special one?
I was pampered enormously. I was indulged with every possible imaginable gift. Whatever I wanted, I got, because I was not only the only child, I was the only grandchild, and I was the only nephew. Mm. So there were loving aunts and uncles around me. There was my mother and my father. There was my beloved grandfather, my paternal grandmother, who lived with us also. So I grew up in this rather busy family home in which there was a lot of comings and goings. We were a small but incredibly close family, very loving, whilst at the same time a little bit crazy.
Yeah, as all families tend
to be. Exactly.
When you were a little boy, what did you want to do when you grew up?
I wanted to be a chef.
Yeah.
Because I loved cooking. My grandfather, who I said lived with us, did all the cooking in the house, and he used to show me how to cook and teach me how to cook. Very basic things, nothing fancy at all. But my first desire when I grew up was to be a chef. Later on, when I reached about age 14 or 15, I wanted to be a psychiatrist. I don't know why. That's just what I wanted to be. When I entered university, I wanted to be a teacher, in particular a music teacher. So my undergraduate degree is in music education, of all things.
Oh.
Yeah. And I spent 3 years teaching music before I left in disgust of the education inventory the educational express that I was involved in. And
what disgusted you about it?
I was assigned to probably the single most dysfunctional school in the tri-state area. It was a very old-fashioned school. We don't have them anymore in America, kindergarten through eighth grade. So we had children between the ages of 5 years of age and 14 years of age in the same huge building. There were six classes of each level. So there were six kindergartens, six first, six second, on and on it went. And they were all grouped homogeneously by level of educational attainment. So that you had kindergarten 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. By the time you got down to kindergarten 6, they were like wild, untamed creatures. And it went on and on like that. The job was impossible. I showed up at school my very first day, and they gave me a little cart with a set of bells on it. And I had to move from room to room, three floors in this building. There was no lift. I had to carry the cart and the set of bells from room to room, and I was to teach music to all these children. And one particular day, I might have kindergarten 3 immediately followed by eighth grade 6. So sometimes in the same room even, because they were shifting around a lot. I remember it vividly because on my very first day of teaching, a girl in eighth grade punched her teacher, male, and knocked him out on the third floor landing of the school.
Okay, that's a challenging place to teach.
That was a very challenging place. The principal of the school had been retired for a long time, but still in position, you know.
Yes.
spent most of his time sitting in the office. Lovely man, Mr. Luby, long since deceased, of course. The school was impossible. Mm. It was a wild place. It was absolutely untamable. And my job there was impossible. I could complete it.
So when you left in disgust, did you have a plan what you were going to do next?
No, I did not have a plan. I came to Ireland to make a visit with my wife and young child, just to clear the head. Mm. It was our second trip, actually, because our first trip, I think, was in the first year of our marriage.
Did you have links to Ireland? Was there a family background there?
Well, it goes back several generations. My great-great-grandmother was from Listowel. She was a Hannon. And there's a lot of Hannons down there, apparently. So we weren't one of those families that did the roots thing.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't checking and shifting. I don't think there's any distinguished ancestors in my family tree. Most of them might have been hung off the family tree, probably. But I grew up with wonderful stories about Ireland that my paternal grandmother used to tell me all the time. She would put on this very stage Irish brogue. Clara Carey was her name. Wonderful old woman. And she would tell me stories about Ireland, that all of which she made up, by the way. They had no truth. So I was steeped in Irish lore. I also grew up in an Irish-American community. You know about America. It's incredibly homogeneous, but we live in – sorry, it's heterogeneous, incredibly, but we live in homogeneous communities. So there was I in the Irish-American community on the border of the Italian-American community, on the border of the German-American community, the Lithuanian-American community, the Puerto Rican community, the Black American community. We're all mixed together in school, but we all went home to our own little enclave. So there I was in Irish America, and it was a crazy way to grow up. And we were steeped in all these wonderful stories. And of course, this was a time when, who's that group? I can't think of them now. The Clancy Brothers.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, we're really big in America. So we were listening to rebel songs and praising, you know, up the IRA and all that kind of stuff. So there was steeped in me a fantasized, perhaps, love of all things Irish and Ireland. Mm. And when I grew up to be a young adult, I joined the Ancient Order of Hibernians.
My word. Okay, I do have to take a commercial break, so we'll just take a commercial break. We'll continue with this story after that. David was telling us about something about his early life growing up, the town he grew up with, how he trained to be a music teacher, and his first experience of teaching in a school was somewhat traumatic. So you left that and came to Ireland to clear the head.
Yeah, that was just a friendly family visit. We had our oldest daughter with us. We only had the one at the time. Erin came with us. And we had a lovely, lovely 3-week visit, and we toured around, et cetera, et cetera. And I just kind of fell in love with Ireland. I don't know why. I felt like I belonged here for some reason. I remember as a child, Sean, and I can't explain this, I never felt like I should be an American. It's just the strangest thing, because when I was a schoolboy, I would spend hours looking in my history books at pictures of European cities. and imagine that I lived in them.
Yeah.
And so when I first came to Ireland and or Europe, if Ireland back in those days could be considered a part of Europe, I felt like this is where I belonged for some strange, inexplicable reason. And so that stayed with me a long, long time. I had to go home, of course. I had to find work. And so I did. I found work working in a steel mill, of all things, where I was moving barrels around the floor. Each barrel empty weighed 64 pounds, and it was filled to the top with steel electrical casings of various kinds. So they weighed hundreds of pounds, and I developed forearms like Popeye at the time, rolling these barrels all over the place. I remember it well because it was quite it was a foundry and a steel mill at the same time. I didn't work in the foundry end. I worked in the end where they polished and finished the fittings that had been molded in the foundry end. But from time to time, frequently, in fact, men who worked there would come up to me, people that I didn't even know, because word has spread there was this man who used to be a teacher working here, and I was considered a human oddity. Yeah. They just couldn't get their heads around this. So we'd say, are you the guy that used to be a teacher? Yes. What the hell are you doing here? How could you possibly have ended up in this horrible place? So for a year I did that anyway, and then I ended up in graduate school.
Training for what?
Counseling and counseling psychology.
Now, so that's, if you like, professionally, you were then set on the path you're on now.
Yes.
To go back a wee bit, you did mention you were adopted. When did you find out you were adopted?
Oh, God. Now, this is where it really gets crazy. I have had for most of my life, it's an image that's now resolved, as you'll see shortly, burned into my consciousness a scene in which I was lying in bed as a young boy of around maybe 12, and my mother coming into the room and sitting on the edge of the bed and waking me up and saying to me, and I can remember it like it was yesterday, David, how do you feel about adopted children? And I remember crying and crying and crying. And she looked at me and said, oh, never mind, never mind. It's a silly question anyway. Later on, as I grew up, I couldn't remember if I had dreamed that memory or if it actually happened.
Mm.
And it transpired that when I was around age 26 or 27, I decided I'd go and ask my mother finally, am I adopted or am I not adopted? And so I went to her. I'll admit on this day I was a little bit emotional, should we say? I had acquired some Dutch courage, and asked her. And she broke down crying and said, yes, I should have told you a long time ago. And it's very odd that you're here, David, today asking me, because it was only last week your sister rang me looking to make contact with you. And it was at that moment that I knew I had a sister and a brother that I had never met. And so this weird coincidence of going to my mother as a young adult, asking if I was in fact adopted and wondering, having spent years wondering whether this was a real memory that had happened or had I dreamt this thing, and it was a very distressing memory. And then at the same time, my sister that I had never met reaching out to my mother, because you remember the woman that raised me, my mother and my birth mother, were first cousins. Mm. They had kept contact with each other all through the years, but I was never allowed to meet my birth mother. Back in those days, such things were absolutely forbidden. And so that's how I found out I was adopted. Not the best way to do things,
Indeed,
Sean.
Now, you know better than most people how parents do the wrong thing for the right reasons.
Yeah.
How did you feel towards your mother for having kept this from you? Towards her parents?
Yeah, for that. Well, my father was deceased at the time that I found this out. Very ambivalent. A mixture of great sadness and anger. I suppose a good bit of rage as well. Disappointment. That for some reason she couldn't be honest with me. The story gets incredibly complicated, actually, and I really won't have enough time to go into it. But my best friend knew all along that I was adopted. His name was Bill, and he's still alive. If you're out there, Bill, hello. And he was forbidden by his mother to tell me. His mother and my mother were the best friends, and my mother finally had fessed up to Bill's mother. Yes, I adopted David a long time ago, but don't tell anyone. So she, of course, told her son.
Yeah.
And I, Bill being my best friend, from time to time when we were going out together as young adults, out to the pub and whatnot, I would say to him, God, I have this awful memory, and I don't know if it really happened or if it really did. And actually, it was he that instigated me going to my mother, because one day, after probably hundreds of conversations where I said to him, was it a dream? Was it this? He got fed up and said, oh, for God's sakes, I'm going to tell you now. You're adopted. And actually, it was the next day that I went to my mother. Now, to make things even a little crazier, if that isn't crazy enough, I had two lifelong, and still have, thanks be to God, best friends, my good friend Bob and my friend Bill, who Bill had divulged to me that I was adopted. My friend Bob, who we were inseparable. We went through university together, and even as young marrieds, we got together with our wives and whatnot quite regularly. My mother, at the end of this lengthy conversation about whether I was adopted or not, looked at me and said, now I'm going to tell you another secret, David, but you must never tell anyone. Bob is adopted.
Pardon me for laughing, but it's almost a sitcom in a sick kind of a way.
It's yes, it's sort of melodramatic, isn't it, you know? So she dropped this bomb on me, and that was, of course, I think that's a little vignette that more than anything encapsulates my mother's personality, you know? She was a conflicted woman who had lived a very, very hard life, filled with love, but also filled with anger, with a tremendous temper that could at times be quite violent. She had grown up in an alcoholic family. Her earliest memory is being held under the water pump in the kitchen of her family farm whilst her mother pumped water over her head to keep her from crying, because the mother, the grandmother, and the grandfather had had a raging fight as a result of his alcoholism. So there was a lot of conflict and damage in her life. She had spent 5 years in a tuberculosis sanatorium between the ages of 16 and 21. And tuberculosis back in those days was the AIDS of its time. You lost all your friends. No one would visit you. So there she was, isolated. And those 5 years formed her character. Those were the days of the open-air cure. The beds were wheeled outside in the middle of winter, and you were bundled up, and they taught you to knit and crochet and do what she called tatting, which is a kind of fine embroidery and whatnot. She always reflected back on those years as the best years of her life, because she made so many friends. As an older woman, she was very ill and had numerous hospitalizations, numerous surgeries, two knee replacements, double mastectomy, hysterectomy. It just went on and on and on. But one day she looked at me whilst I was visiting her in the hospital. She was quite elderly at the time. And she said, you know, David, I know why God does this to me. And I said, what are you talking about, Mom? She said, sends me to the hospital and makes me sick like this. Why, Mom? So I can make new friends. And wherever she went in the hospital, she made new friends, and she always kept them. They were always in touch with her afterwards. She had this great, vivacious, outgoing, larger-than-life personality. Regrettably, she married a man who was the polar opposite, a quiet, introverted, somewhat depressive person who had, as far as I know, no friends whatsoever. No one ever came calling for my father. He never went out. He was a hard-working man, walking to work. Took him 2 hours to walk to work every day and 2 hours to walk home every day with a bad back. He just worked and worked and worked and gave all the money to my mother for the running of the family. He would keep $3 a week for himself, and he would put that in a little savings account so we could buy my mother a Christmas present every year. He was a very interesting man as I look back on it. I had a very strange and distant relationship with him, mostly because...
Now, to go back a bit again, you had this conversation with your mother. She said your friend Bob was adopted, but don't tell anybody. Did Bob ever find out he was adopted?
To the best of my knowledge, no, because unlike my friend Bill, I kept the secret.
Presumably because the day your mother told you, when you're 27 years of age, she'd only be contacted by one of your siblings
that you
didn't know existed.
Yes.
To make contact with you. Did you make contact with them?
Yes, I did. I rang her up because my mother had given me the phone number. I organized to meet her. And I traveled not too far. She lived only in the neighboring town, so maybe 45 minutes away. And there I was, and she had organized to have all her children and her nieces and nephews there. And she had imagined what I think was an Oprah Winfrey reunion, that we were all going to hug and kiss, and everything was going to be wonderful from there on in. And it didn't work like that for me. Maybe this is my pathology, but I felt very distant from her. We look incredibly alike, as do both of my daughters, and my birth mother, by the way. There's a huge, enormous family resemblance. So she had all these wonderful ideas in her head that this was going to be great, and she began to tell me about our mother, my birth mother, and her mother, who she absolutely hated. And she began to tell me all these bad things about my mother. And she also began to speak about my brother, who I learned had died at age 14 in a very, very freak accident. I later discovered that I was actually in attendance at his funeral and wake. But I was a very young boy and didn't know it. I had no idea. But I have these, and still have sometimes, these memory flashes of being in this room that I now know is a funeral parlor, and people coming around and people greeting me and looking at me. So people must have known who I was. Obviously, my birth mother would have been there. So my brother at age 14 had been out camping in his back garden with his friends. They had erected a little tent. A storm blew up. This is the story as I understand it. His mother said, "Come on in, children, you'll all get wet." He stayed behind to stay in the tent to finish reading a comic book, and a tree fell over on the tent and killed him. Now, my sister had handed me a packet of papers, newspaper clippings of the accident, because it made the front pages of all the local newspapers, so I knew exactly where this was. And the next day I drove down there to that particular house, with no relatives living there at the time, and walked into the back garden. And there I could see the tree exactly where it had fallen, and the wall where it had fallen, because the newspaper had taken very explicit photographs of the wall, and it was bloodstained and whatnot, where the tree had fallen over on him. And it was a very strange experience. But anyway, as a result of having met my sister and her presenting me the gift of her pain, and damage, I didn't want to see her again.
Yeah.
And I haven't, except at my mother's funeral 6 years ago when she approached
me. You share the same father with those siblings?
Well, this is where it gets a little bit complicated. To be honest, I don't know, because the story as I was told it is that my birth mother's husband denied his paternity of me.
Do you know why?
I don't know why. No one would tell me. Neither my mother nor her sister, my aunt, Margaret, who was a larger-than-life person in my personal history. So they wouldn't tell me, or maybe they didn't know either. I really don't know. It's quite odd because I was adopted into my mother and father's family. My mother's sister was married to a man named David, who was the brother of my birth mother's husband. Can you follow all that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's complicated.
It's quite complicated.
To put it mildly. Now, I assume at this point that you made contact with your sister that your birth mother had passed away. Was she still alive?
No. As far as I know, she's still alive.
Any contact
living,
with her?
Living in, and of all places, Bethlehem, Connecticut.
Yes, you have to laugh, really.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. Or cry. Yeah. Mostly I laugh now.
At any point in your life, were you ever tempted to try and reestablish contact to make sense of it all?
I get asked that question all the time. Mm. No, is the answer. I think this is a good case of let sleeping dogs lie. I believe she's still alive. The only contact she had would have been with my mother, who's now deceased 6 years. My former wife would have been very, very close to my mother, so she would have known. So I would have to ask my former wife, but that's probably not viable at this stage of the game. So I don't know if she's still alive or not, but it's too many years, Sean.
Yeah.
Too many memories. I've worked through most of that. At least I think I have, and so far as a human being can, you know. This adoption thing is really interesting because it leaves a gap. a gap of who am I really, which is the core question, isn't it? You know who you are. I'm assuming you're not adopted.
No.
So you know who you are. You know about your family heritage. You can go back several generations or you've heard stories. But there's a part for me that I'll never know. There's a hole there. A hole that really can't quite be filled unless I go trying to ferret it all out. I don't know if I want to spend what remaining time I have searching for these answers. I'd rather spend that time living my life and loving my children and my grandchildren and doing my work and feeling that I'm making some tiny little contribution to the world, rather than go delving and diving into the murky depths of the past and not knowing where it will leave me, maybe without enough oxygen to do my work. Who knows?
It's interesting, given what you do for a living, people might make the assumption that the healthy thing to do is that you have to do all that digging and delving, and that perhaps just parking things and moving on is an unhealthy thing to do.
Well, it's highly individualized, yeah. Isn't it? You know, I mean, I think I have dealt with it as much as I can.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that I ignored it and filed it away. I know the stories now. I think I know about the stories that I will ever know. There's no one to ask anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I'm not quite sure my birth mother is alive. She'd be very elderly if she is. She obviously never had any interest. My mother has been dead 6 years, maybe more. You know, I've had no contact. She hasn't reached out to me, and she easily could.
Yes.
So obviously, what would I be doing to her by bringing this back? You know, there's always the other side of that.
Mm.
As a psychologist and a therapist, I have seen people reach out to the adopted parent, and it doesn't always end happily.
Yeah.
Sometimes what they discover is not particularly pretty.
Mm.
And it only causes them more wounds. So I think we have to come to grips with it the best we can as individuals and work it through. There isn't a template for these things. There isn't a one-size-fits-all roadmap. Some people can benefit very much from going back and finding out. Other people don't need to. And some people can be hurt by what they find out.
So you went to graduate school.
Correct.
and concentrated on counseling and psychology.
Yep.
After graduate school, what did you do?
Well, after graduate school, I got a job in this division of psychiatry in a large general hospital in my hometown, Waterbury, Connecticut. It was the largest psychiatric division in any general hospital in the state, and I spent 5 years working there, and it was absolutely wonderful. I thrilled to it, and I have some great, great memories of people I worked with. We were working with an incredibly impaired and damaged population, people with very severe chronic schizophrenia, bipolar disorders, a severe depression. But they were all wonderful and beautiful in their own way, and they taught me so many things about life. I can't even begin. I have so many funny stories of working there. It was hard work. I've had my ribs broken 3 times.
Wow.
By being attacked by patients in the hospital and whatnot. I've been spat and spit on and vomited on and you name it. It's all happened. But it was just great because it helped me understand that all of these people that we would probably walk across the road if we saw them on the other side so as not to meet them are human beings. And they can teach us something and they can bring us a gift about life. No matter how crazy they might seem on the outside. And what do they need more than anything else? Someone to be kind to them, which is what we all need.
Yeah.
Just someone to be kind, who cares enough to listen sometimes and won't get distressed by the fact that, you're a little crazy, so what? I hate to use that word, and I don't mean it in a pejorative way.
Tell us then, you are working in this hospital, David. Did you move to other places around the United States before you came to Ireland?
No, I stayed in the state of Connecticut after I left the hospital because I had really progressed as far as one could progress there. And there reaches a time, I think, at least certainly in my life, that you need to move on. So I took a job as a psychologist in a very large urban school system where I was working in schools with parents and teachers and children, and I did 18 years duty there. But it was rather unfulfilling because it was a job that involved a lot of meetings, a lot of assessment of children, and very little time to actually work with them.
Mm.
But I loved it. It gave me a tremendous inside view of education, some of which has left me with a great deal of questions about what we're really doing to and for children when we're educating them.
Mm.
But after 18 years, I left and came here.
Was it pretty straightforward to move here? Did you have to go through kind of hoops in terms of visas and things like that?
Well, yeah, you do have to do that. You have to get permission, obviously, and work permits and all that sort of thing. But I have been coming back and forth for years and years and years, 2-3 times a year for visits. And I had met a lot of professional colleagues here, particularly in special education here in Ireland. So a friend of mine, now deceased, Sean Griffin, one of the great special educators, was at the time the head of education at the Froebel College, primary teacher training college, previously in Black Rock. Now they've been absorbed into Maynooth. And he rang me up and said, I have a part-time job for you. I had told him, look, I'm unhappy in my work. And by that time, the children were growing. I had a bit of freedom. Do I really have to stay in the States or can I go? He said, I have some part-time work for you here at the college. And so I said, oh, great. Okay, I'll take it. And why not take a chance, you know? I often think my life is a bit like one of those silly video games, Mario or something, where you wander around and a door opens up out of nowhere, and you either go through it or you don't, you know? So this was one of those moments where the door opened up, and I said, oh, what the hell? I'll go through it. And I believe very much in what Joseph Campbell used to say. He was a great author about myths and whatnot. And he was, as a university professor, he used to encounter students all the time who said, I don't know what to do. I don't know what I want to be. Here I am in university. Where am I going? And he would say to them all the time, just follow your bliss. If you follow your bliss, doors will open that you never knew existed. And that was something that stuck with me. Mm. And I remember thinking about that after Sean called me. Well, look, this is a chance. I mean, you either say yes or no. If you say yes, you take a chance, and if it works out, great. If you say no, that chance may never, ever come again.
Yeah.
And so I said yes, and now it's very nearly 20 years later, and here I am.
The reality of living in Ireland, was that different?
Oh, incredibly different. And of course, I arrived here nearly 20 years ago. Sean, I can honestly tell you, and you know this better than I suppose, the Ireland I arrived in no longer exists.
Mm.
It's utterly changed forever. I'm not entirely convinced the change is good. The sense of community has been quite eroded, unfortunately, and the pace of life is no different than the pace of life in living in the States.
Mm.
It's just as frenetic. And we work, 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 and it seems as though we're living in order to work instead of working in order to live, and I question that all the time, both in myself and other people I see. So it's an Ireland that I came to that's gone and that's evolving and changing so rapidly, probably too rapidly, I think. We don't know exactly where we're going yet, and it's a little bit scary for everyone, myself included, but I do love it, and I love being close to Europe. I visit Greece very frequently. I have a wonderful affinity for Greece and the Greek people, and a great sorrow for the suffering that's being imposed on them, at least largely in part through their own unfortunate malfeasance. And so I travel over there a lot, and just 2 weeks ago I was there.
You did mention that music education was where you started. Do you play an instrument?
I no longer play any instrument, unfortunately, and shame on me, I must say. My first instrument was the piano accordion. That was the big instrument when I was growing up in a
boy. You must have got a lot of girlfriends with that one.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. and then, of course, it was superseded by the guitar. But in secondary school, high school, I started playing the clarinet.
Mm.
And when I entered the School of Fine Arts at the University of Connecticut as an undergraduate, I was a clarinet major. But we were made, because I was majoring in music education, we had to take 4 semesters of piano.
Mm.
So I can play the piano badly, but I can play it. I can play the clarinet and the saxophone and the flute, woodwinds. We also had to take a semester of an instrument from every group. I took a semester of violin. That was a disaster. Trumpet was even a bigger disaster.
So, but do you have any instruments in your home?
No, I do not. Aww. And I'm very much interested now in getting a mandolin. Why? Because it's small and you can carry it around easy. It's not heavy.
That's true. That's a good point. Do you, are there things that you do to maintain your own mental health?
Yes. I'm a great cinephile. I love the cinema. I have a wonderful collection of DVDs. Actually, before I entered university, I wanted to go to NYU and be a film studies major.
Mm.
And I was particularly interested in the very early silent era, between 1896 and 1906. Go figure.
Yeah.
You know? Esoteric. So I have at home a wonderful collection of silent films, all the major directors and classics and whatnot, plus a huge collection of other films. So I watch movies. I get interested in historical nonfiction. So right now I'm reading very heavily into the Balkan era, early 19th century. Particularly, I'm interested now in the atrocities that were committed between the Turks, the Greeks, and the Armenians in 1922, between 1919, 1922, 24. That's my current area of reading interest. And that keeps me sort of sane. Mm-hmm. And this year, I've made up my mind to take up photography as a hobby, so I've bought myself as a Christmas present a camera.
All right.
A proper camera.
Yeah.
Not just a point-and-shoot job.
Yeah. Good for you. Do you have any ambitions? Are there things that David Carey still wants to do?
I want to live a peaceful life. I want to be able to love and be loved. I want to be irascible from time to time and cranky, which I've succeeded at, apparently, so people tell me. I want to work smarter, not harder. I have been working very hard for 5 or 6 years now as a private practitioner, and it is quite demanding emotionally and demanding of my time. I love to travel. I absolutely love Europe, and I've traveled extensively throughout Europe. I've worked in Africa and Kenya and created quite a successful, in its time, development program there in the slums of Kibera in Nairobi. I was bringing young teachers over there to teach for a month under the most horrific conditions. I absolutely loved that work. Kenyans are among the most wonderful people on planet Earth. I learned so much from these people who were living in a kind of poverty that we have never really seen or smelled. But yet their spirit is filled with the love of people and things and their God, of course, because they are very fervent Christians, most of them, and a lot of them Muslims, very fervent. I learned so much from them. I miss that work very badly and would love to start another project. I fear I've probably run out of time and energy for that kind of thing. But that is inside of me still, wanting to go back to meet my friends, to go back into Kibera, to visit some of the small schools with mud floors and mud walls that we were working in, and see some of those teachers again.
Do you believe in God?
Not in the sense of a deity up there with a gray beard who actively intervenes in the course of human events. I think I'm more of a spiritual person. I know that's such a hackneyed thing to say. Everybody says that. I'm not a churchgoer. I think God has a lot to answer for if we're going to think about God. So, yes and no. It's important to be nice to people, and it's important to be nice to yourself. Eugene O'Neill, the great American tragedian, wrote in The Great God Brown, one of his early plays, long forgotten, "Man is born broken. He lives to be mended. The grace of God is glue." I often extend that and think about what Jesus said, "Wherever two or more of you are gathered in my name, there I am." So what is the grace of God to mend us but other people?
David, having spoken to you for an hour, I want to speak to you for another hour, but we don't have the chance to do that. David Carey, thanks a million for talking to us today. That was the interview that we played with David Carey. That was played out originally on Christmas Day in 2013. He did, for your information, he did buy that camera, and he was a very keen photographer for many years after that. And you know what? Even though probably a lot of you have tears in your eyes listening to that. Now, we had tears in our eyes that day that we recorded it, because I remember Caroline Clark, the producer at the time, was bawling and gave him a hug. We'll really, really, really miss him.